You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Her work supported by the Ford Foundation, the MacArthur Foundation, the National Center on Race and Digital Justice. She delves into how bias in predictive technologies affects adolescent racial, gender, and sociopolitical identity development. As an educator, she has taught and designed courses on subjects like digital privacy, data science ethics, and adolescent development. Ariel also co-leads AI for Abolition, an organization dedicated to increasing AI literacy and building open source AI tools for marginalized communities. Her scholarship has not only appeared in academic journals and handbooks, but has also reached wider audiences through publications like The Atlantic and the Emmy-nominated PBS documentary TikTok Boom. Please welcome Avrielle Epps. Thank you very much.
Hello, everyone. Good evening. Thank you so much for being here with us today. Hi. And thank you so much to Jessica and the Aloud team for partnering with me on this event series and making this conversation and this dialogue that we're about to have possible. I'm really excited for it. So I would like to just go ahead and introduce our panelists for tonight and get the conversation going. First, we have Henriette Kramer. Henriette Kramer is the co-founder of Paper Moon AI, which is an AI safety startup that combines quantitative large-scale data and in-depth qualitative feedback from people to understand both what is happening and also why it's happening in AI systems. Prior, she was the director of algorithmic impact and responsibility at Spotify, which is where I met her and had the pleasure of working with her. Henriette has extensive product and research experience in recommenders, search, robot, voice, and advertising applications. She holds multiple patents, has 60 plus research publications, and a PhD revolving around trust and AI from the University of Amsterdam. She's based in San Francisco as well. Also, please welcome Patrice Cullors. Patrice Cullors is a New York Times bestselling author, educator, artist, and abolitionist from Los Angeles, California. She has been on the front lines of abolitionist movement, building with Black Lives Matter, Justice LA, Dignity and Power Now, and Reform LA Jails. Cullors is also the co-founder of the Crenshaw Dairy Mart, the founding director of the Social and Environmental Arts MFA program at Prescott College, and the founder of the Center for Art and Abolition. With the mission to invite all of us to grow toward abolition through intergenerational healing, work that centers love, collective care, and art, Cullors' current work and practice focuses on abolitionist aesthetics. She is also a recipient of numerous awards for her art and activism. Her work has been featured throughout Los Angeles and, frankly, throughout the entire world. We're very lucky to have her with us. And then finally, we'll be joined by John Lopez. John Lopez started his career covering entertainment and the arts for Grantland, Vanity Fair, and Business Week, among others. He was an associate producer on Hossein Amini's adaptation of The Two Faces of January and has written for Paramount Plus's Strange Angel, Netflix's 7 Seconds, and Amazon's The Terminal List. He participated as a member of the Writers Guild of America's AI Working Group in the run-up to their 2023 contract negotiations, which I'm sure everyone in this room followed very closely. Please help me welcome to the stage Henriette, John, and Patrice. Great, thank you all so much for being here. This is our second series in this event, and I'm really just excited to hear from all of you and have you share your expertise with us. So I wanted to just start by having each of you talk briefly about what brought you to the work that you do in this field as it relates to AI. Why do you care about it, and why should the audience care?
Hi, everyone, and thank you for organizing, and very nice to have this discussion tonight. So I started with an interest in both the human side and the machine learning side. Been in this area of working on, like, how do things like interaction design or the wider context of a technical system actually influence how people use it? And when I started, this was sort of an academic fun endeavor. You would have like a robot prototype or something. Whereas now, why I think this is so important is it permeates everything. And we actually have a quite hard time to figure out, how do you even measure the impact of this? How do we do better? And I really enjoyed participating in discussions like this with people from different backgrounds, because we need to have, for very specific domains and very specific problems, very concrete ways to show how we can do better. And for that, it's critically important that it's not just, here's the policy people, here's the tech people, here's some artist work going on, here's some negotiation. We need to start translating between those different things. And previously, that was my job at a large tech company. How do you do this translation? And now I'm really curious at, hey, how can we do this for other organizations and figure out what's real, what's not so real, and how can we actually do better when we build something with AI?
Hey. Well, I'm a writer and I do some science fiction writing, so you're always interested in that kind of stuff. You know, killer robots and all that. Also, I love science. I think science is amazing. One of my like small things as a TV writer is to try and bring as much scientific reality into any of the shows that I work on as I can. You know, people get afraid of science and there's no reason to be afraid, especially math. My passion project, which, you know, one day I'll find some tech billionaire maybe to give me money to make it. I want to do a biography of Kurt Gödel, who's like one of the great mathematicians and logicians in history. But also, as a result, I have a lot of friends in the field. I'm curious, I ask questions, and a lot of my friends were working in the field of AI, specifically large language models and image generators, you know, several years ago. And I remember during the pandemic, my wife and I took a trip up to San Francisco, and one of my friends was like, hey, there's this thing we're working on. Do you want to play with it? Because I want to see how it imitates your writing. And it was called GPT-3, which is the precursor to ChatGPT. And I played with it for a second, and I was like, wow, this is kind of cool. Kind of imitates me. It's not as good as me, I think. But that's weird. I didn't know computers could do that. And then I started to ask him questions, because I'm curious about how it works. And then I explained, I was like, oh, so you just scrape the internet, and you put it in a server? Oh, okay, and then you did this? Oh, did you ask about like the works that went into oh, no, you didn't. Okay, cool. And I kind of forgot about all that. And then in November, ChatGPT debuted. And at the time, the Writers Guild was getting ready for our contract negotiations. And I am not alone as being like a tech nerdy guy in the WGA. There are a lot of us who are. And there was an AI working group getting started, looking at the issues that had been more theoretical until ChatGPT came out. And I emailed the Guild. And when you email the Guild being like, hey, this is a big thing. There's a lot of money behind this. Silicon Valley is really mobilizing in a way that it rarely mobilizes. Or, it, you know, when it mobilizes, it puts a lot of money in power. And in the Guild, when you email someone, your reward or punishment is that you get asked to help. But it was great, because I met a bunch of fellow writers. We worked really hard meeting, researching, sharing information, and then presenting to our board members and our negotiating committee our research and advocating for why this is a thing that's gonna, this isn't going away. Like, what has happened with AI, machine learning, neural networks? Like, this is kind of like a new way of using computing power that is just gonna be a fact of the world, and it opens up a whole bag of questions, and there's a lot of money on one side of the equation trying to determine how our world is structured and who benefits from that. So it's super important that we at the Guild deal with this, and to the credit of our board and our leadership, they got it, they heard us, they interfaced with the labor lawyers, they came up with the demands. And, you know, in a weird way, we were lucky that ChatGPT did come out in November 22, because we were able to then put that on the table. And also in a way that became public, and that I think opened up a lot of people who might not otherwise have listened, opened their eyes to what was going on and how the world was changing. Because we knew that what was going to happen was not going to affect just Hollywood writers, but everyone and every creative, every artist. And it already is, and we can talk about it more. But so yeah, it's super important, and there's a lot of money behind it. So whenever that happens, you know, you get involved and you want to educate people, because that's the number one, that is the number one antidote to power is education.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, and thank you everybody on the panel. It's always weird to like get on a panel and like not talk to the panelists first. And hey everybody in the audience and everybody watching, thank you for bringing us together for this really important conversation. I really come to this conversation as both an abolitionist and an artist, and really interested in the role that AI plays in the fine arts world. There's lots of conversations that are happening right now around image generation and art, fine art in particular. But also I'm really curious about abolition and its relationship to AI. And we'll get into that, and people are probably like, what do those two words have to do with anything? But they have a lot to do with each other. And I think for me, my interest in this conversation is one, you and I have had lots of conversations about AI, and when ChatGPT came out, I was terrified, to be really honest. And I had lots of conversations with Avriel. I was like, I don't know how to get behind this. Like, this is really creeping me out. I, you know, come from a background of community organizing and activism and was really fearful. And we have been really given a sort of narrative around AI and machine learning that is a doomsday narrative. Thank you. I'm also a WGA writer and I really appreciate you. But it's true, Hollywood has sort of painted this picture that like, guess what, this thing is gonna take over and we're all going to crash and die because of it. And so I was like operating off of a lot of fear, and we had all of these conversations. And as we started to have the conversations, my own understanding started to morph, and I started to be like, oh, this thing is what we make it. And we actually have a lot of agency over the thing that is called AI. And so I come at it not from the technical side, I come from it as like a lay person, as an artist that uses AI in some of my artwork, but also as like someone who's really theorizing and philosophizing around how to understand AI as part of a broader vision towards changing the world.
Wow, thank you so much for all of that, all three of you. So I want to start with just kind of a basic question. I think it's a little bit overused in a lot of conversations around machine learning and AI, but the opportunities and the pitfalls with this technology, but specifically in the realm of art and entertainment, what are some of the things that you are seeing that you're excited about and some of the things that you're like, we need to think very critically and cautiously about?
I'll start. So in the entertainment sphere, machine learning, tech, streaming has been a thing for a very long time, right? So you don't want to go in as like the old professor going, yeah, there's nothing new about that. Like that's not absolutely not true. There are a lot of differences here, but it's also understanding what has happened over time. For example, the discussions on responsible AI have actually, they started in the 60s already. There is papers from the 60s about these themes. In entertainment, there's a couple things that I'm excited about and things where I wish things were a little different. So using AI as a tool, right? You put it in the hands of people, but you can make this decision. Is this a tool that I'm designing for specific people, for designers, artists, editors to tell their stories in a more exciting way? Or is this something where it's more utilitarian? So in the end, it's not about the AI per se, but more about what is the human incentive structure and what are the goals that different peoples have here? And are you even consciously thinking about those objectives? Like one of the strange questions that sometimes comes up when you're at a larger tech company, it's the question of how does the algorithm work? Like the algorithm? There's hundreds of different models working together with teams and people, and all of those can make choices. There are things that you could measure, figure out. But what I'm a little worried about is sometimes you don't even have the ways to assess that impact. So you need to do scenario planning, which is from a data science perspective, you go, what's my data set? And I'll calculate the impact of this, and then I do data-informed policy. And that way of working doesn't always work because you may not have the data sets to even be able to evaluate what is the impact on you. Yeah. And scenario planning, which is something that you've actually taken the time to do, which was very impressive.
Well, we kind of had to, because I think our concern is keeping human beings at the center of all of this power and technology that's being used. You know, we as writers and artists, you're constantly being, there's this view, especially amongst people who cut checks, that you're fungible, that you're easily replaceable. And I think there was a lot of expectation and hype when the AI train debuted that, like, this is it. This is the automatic thing that's going to replace everyone. We got Waymo. We don't need taxi drivers anymore. We've got ChatGPT. You don't need screenwriters. You can just whip something up. And that's, like, I think that's an undiscerning understanding of what the technology is doing and how to use it. And unfortunately, the real-world impact of that is it can devalue people's creative work and the amount of money that they get paid to do it. You know, we in the guild were lucky because we had a guild. We had power to force a contract and a negotiation with our employers. But you look at what's going on with concept artists right now, like their wages are dropping precipitously, and there's something really unethical in my mind, you know, not speaking officially for the guild, but you know, just what I know, whereby someone's work in art has been fed into a machine and then derivative content is being used, and that is now actively replacing them in the market. Like we have copyright laws, we have business legislation, there's the Berne Convention, all these things that for hundreds of years governed how people's work was used, and now to see it weaponized against them in a way that is probably some form of plagiarizing or infringing in many bad ways. Like the WGA was lucky. We were able to fight for protections, but not everyone has a union or a guild, and it's kind of a, you know, unfortunate thing. And so it's like, how do you make sure that all this computing power, which is being, I mean, godless amounts of money and computing power are being thrown into this stuff, how do you keep the human focus forward? You know, for us as writers, it's like obviously, you know, business thing. Like, hey, we need to be, everyone needs to be able to make a living. But also as artists, how, you know, what is the point of art if not to communicate human to human? Like, what is it you're doing when you're interacting with a work of art? And what does it mean when you intermediate that with a machine? Like, what are the issues that you do, what you introduce when you are not thoughtful about how you use that? And I think that's something that relates to everyone.
Can you ask the question again?
Yeah, just when you think about AI-driven platforms and algorithms and their impact on artistic practices and industries, what do you see as the potential opportunities and some of the pitfalls that we want to avoid?
I'll start with pitfalls. I mean, I think the like big word here is capitalism,
yeah,
and exploitation.
And extraction, as John is talking
about.
Yeah,
exactly. And I think we have to, when we're talking about AI and its role inside of the art world, like we have to actually like talk about capitalism and exploitation and extraction. So I think that to me is like the interesting way into this conversation around art, especially as a fine artist where we don't have a union, where we're some of the most exploited artists, where there is not a lot of clarity around IP. There's just, it's like the Wild Wild West in the art world, it just is. And there is a ton of conversations happening right now where people are trying to understand like the ethics, like is it ethical to use AI in fine art? And then there's some artists who are using it and it's really cool and they have a lot of agency around it. And I think it's a evolving conversation that we should all be participating in. And I think for me, like the opportunities is, it's always exciting when there is new technology to use to advance creativity. Like that's just exciting. And I think when humans are at the helm of it, and when we have autonomy and agency inside of it, and it's not being, we're not being pitted against each other, or corporations aren't coming in and then using their dollars and money to, you know, de-resource us or divest from us, like, there's a lot of excitement to be able to use this technology. So I feel like in the art world, like, a lot of us are trying to kind of wrap our heads around, like, how do we want to ethically use these technologies? And also, like, a lot of us are using it. We just are. We're using it. And we're in sort of these, like, kind of smaller conversations. And I don't feel like we're not at the WGA level because we don't have a union in that way. And I do think WGA, like, led the way in having us kind of, in the creative community, think about how we respond to machine learning and its impact on creativity. So I just want to thank you for that.
Well, thank you guys, and maybe you guys need a union.
Yes, we do.
We all do.
Amen.
I want to, Henriette, I'm really curious about your perspective on this because, one, you've been doing this work from a technical side for a very long time. Two, the music industry is, like, the way that technology has impacted the music industry much, much, like, when I was, like, a teenager, essentially, was such an interesting thing to watch, and I see so many parallels with kind of the rise of music streaming and even this conversation that we're having with generative AI right now and art. And so from your perspective, what do you think we need to be considering in this moment as we're thinking about AI-driven platforms' impact on music artist practices and, like, the music industry specifically?
So the very first thing, that it is never just the technology, right? So it's the humans and organizations that are using that for their particular purposes and the understanding of that. So an interesting thing that's happening now is because things are moving quite fast, the gap between professional communities that can actually, you know, get organized, yep, and find better ways, yep, those gaps are still quite big. Mm-hmm. So it's extremely important to have those conversations and go, okay, this is how you get organized. Okay, these are the technical things. And yes, I know you may think it works like this, but it doesn't quite. But also being very, very concrete about what is the exact problem here, what is the situation, and not just making assumptions that, oh, it will have a positive or negative impact, actually looking at how do you assess that. And that is currently quite lacking because it's much easier to create a really cool system and a really cool demo, and that's quite frankly also really fun work. I personally even love doing that, right? Like, doing that makes you also realize with that is really fun, and sometimes this really complicated work that I'm trying to do of figuring out, all right, what is the exact impact? Mm-hmm. Do I even have the data to audit this? Mm-hmm. And even though I personally found that work very inspiring and important, building a cool demo is still more fun, right? So those gaps and learning from those different communities right now is super, super important because things are going this fast. So you can't just go, oh, we'll figure it out here on our own. And that is sometimes really difficult to see when you see all these conversations just moving in directions where, like, there is 30 years of technical work on that. Mm-hmm. Like, please learn from those methods. Just ask someone who's done this before. And that I think is really, really important right now. Talked a little less about music, but
fine.
Well, what's interesting to me is when I was talking to some of my AI friends who were educating me about this, the first thing they showed me was the music generators. Like, they were able to do this, in, like you were saying backstage, you know, machine learning is not new. It's been around for a while. We just haven't seen it. Like, the iceberg tip is just now coming up. And I remember he showed me, oh, we can make Bach cantatas. And this was like 2016, 2017, somewhere thereabouts. And I'm like, wow, you can just, and I remember asking, can you do that with, like, someone's work, a contemporary artist's work? Like, what do you think the recording industry of America thinks about that? And he got really quiet. And he's like, well, we're not gonna do that. And it was because of Napster. you know, there was this recognition on the tech companies' parts that they kind of like lost, they kind of lost a little bit of a battle. And so I find it interesting now that like those new services, like what is it, Sudo and the other one that came out, where it's like people are just making, you know, songs that sound a lot like pop songs that are very popular. It's only now when like the technology is kind of diffused outside of the big holders of it that now suddenly you're seeing those things pop up. Mm-hmm. Because you like the Googles and the Microsofts were afraid of like lawsuits, but now there's been this kind of thing where, like, well, you know what, let's just try it. Let's just go out there and see what happens. And again, the technology was there, but people weren't thinking about the impact and the consequences.
Yeah, absolutely. I, in continuing this conversation about impact and you know, what should we be thinking about, can you talk to us about, John, the framework that WGA was using to think about AI? Like, what specifically were you asking for? What did you win? What things do you wish you had won, maybe?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, first off, we just wanted to get some regulation on the table because I think that...
Sorry, before that, could you just give a little bit of background about the strikes for folks who may
yes.
not have followed
yes.
them?
Yes, sorry. All right. So our strikes happened last year. If you lived in LA, you probably saw us around all the studio lights, lots waving our signs. There had been a lot of issues because of streaming and how writers were being compensated that were turning the profession into kind of like what we call a gig economy job, where, you know, writing has always been somewhat gigified, but we had fought over the course of decades for healthcare, residuals that were meaningful, that allowed writers to continue to make a living and like maybe buy a house in between jobs and all this kind of stuff. And somehow, because streaming was a new technology, like the studios took that as an opportunity to kind of like renegotiate those terms. So we knew that that issue was coming up. Then, you know, we talked about AI and the board was like, all right, we're gonna make asks for that. The studios did not respond at all. We went on strike, you know, specifically in regards to AI, the studios were like, it's too new of a technology. And, you know, as a guild, we kind of know, no, you gotta like get in there right away. You gotta like set, you gotta set the parameters because people never go backwards and look back and say, oh, you were right. This was, this did turn out pretty bad for you guys. Here, we'll give you something. Never happens in any negotiation. It took 153 days to get terms that we felt we could live with. But we did. And everyone at the time said, oh, you're never going to get anything. You're never going to get like minimum number of writers for writers' rooms, which is something that streaming had been squeezing the writers' room, which if you're a creative, you know the heart, the reason TV shows work when they're good is almost universally because there's a writers' room of very talented people, like individuals interacting with each other, like creating a creative ferment that allows for magic to happen. And, you know, because of the business, the economics of the business, you know, the studios were like, nah, you need less and less of those people, and that's just not true. If you're a workaday creative, you know that. But, you know, the things that we did get, which were very great, were we got the right to say that it's up to the writer how they want to use AI. This is not something that's going to be forced down your throat. Like, if the writer wants to use it, if the studio wants to use it, if it's agreeable and ethical or whatever, then, it, of course, it can be used. We're not against, we're not, you know, anti-tech, we're anti-exploitation.
That's right.
The other big thing that we got is that it can't be used to pay us less, because I think there's this conception that somehow this technology is going to make the job easier for writers. So far, in my experience, that has not been the case with ChatGPT. Like, more often than not, if you know how these things are constructed, they kind of give you a derivative, an average, something that kind of approaches the median or the mean. And as a writer, what you're trying to do is you're trying to find something somewhat new that is also familiar. You know, we like to say in television that we're the one industry where our audience is as expert as the people making it. So you're kind of staying ahead of the curve. You're trying to find the thing that audiences will like, and audiences change and grow. You know, ChatGPT, the way it's constructed, it tends to be frozen in time. You know, when the data is run through the training, you know, the training run, it kind of freezes it in place. So it wasn't necessarily the case that this was going to make our jobs easier, but studios would look at it and say, oh, now you have ChatGPT that can generate 50 pages as opposed to, you know, in 5 minutes, whereas it takes you a week to generate 50 pages. Well, we're going to pay you less for that. That's not true, because the 50 pages ChatGPT generates is not really usable. To generate 50 good pages does sometimes take a week. You know, there's this mistake that writing is typing, and it's not, it's thought. That was the big one. And then the one that I think is kind of a larger issue that I think kind of impacts everyone, it impacts SAG, DGA, it impacts all people, is like, whether or not someone's work can be used as training data without their compensation, you know, without their consent, without their compensation, without their consultation. And implicitly, that's what has happened with these large language models. You know, they hoovered up the internet. They hoovered up everything on there, like my writing, your writing, you know, your family photos. It's all in the model, and it can all be used to remix and to generate stuff. And it's kind of like, that's not really questionable. And we've seen there are massive lawsuits out there to determine, like, the legality, whether that is. And I personally think it's probably illegal. That's my opinion. I'm not a lawyer, but I've talked to enough lawyers to know that that's, like, not an unreasonable opinion to have. And so I think the question that really is vital to creatives and probably to a lot of people whose work will be incorporated into AI in the future is, what is the right of the person who creates that training data? Like, when did they get compensated? What is their participation in the profit that is derived from that? And how do they get consent? That's a huge question. OpenAI just added 7 very expensive lawyers to its team last week because it knows its lawsuit with the New York Times is life and death. So that's something that, like, ultimately was an issue that went beyond what we could get with the studios, because the studios' argument was like, well, Microsoft did it. Like, they were able to train up on all your work. Why can't we? And it's like, whoa. This is a larger conversation. Anyway, you know, and that is something that I think remains to be fought in courts and hopefully through the Copyright Office. You know, there's this kind of, like, great outpouring amongst writers because we were on strike. The U.S. Copyright Office was doing an AI initiative, and a lot of our members wrote in. Like, if you can go to the Copyright Office comments on AI, and you can find Vince Gilligan, who wrote Breaking Bad, writing about, like, what he thinks the ethics and responsibility of artificial intelligence systems are. So, you know, those are some of the victories, and then I think that big final battle of, like, what does it mean? How are we treating the training data that goes into the systems? Which, again, the training data is our work. It's your work, my work, your work. It's all in there, yeah. More or less.
Yeah. I mean, in this, you know, we're this concept of this is more than just a conversation about technology. It is a conversation about power. I've heard, I think, multiple people say here. And so Patrice is somebody who, you know, has a long history of organizing against systems that abuse their power. And as an artist, what do you feel is the role of art in this fight for algorithmic justice or, you know, AI rights?
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Well, one, I think everybody should just recognize that we have power here. And I think when you're not sort of been in the tech world or you don't know, like, these terms, or, you know, ChatGPT comes on and you're like, whoa, what's happening? I mean, I've been in many rooms or Avriel's presenting, and people really are scared. They're just like, this is the end of, like, the thing, and the robots are coming, and there's all this fear, and it's like, it's downhill from here. And I think as an organizer, just giving everybody, like, the recognition, like, guess what? We all have agency over this thing. And it may not feel that way, and it may feel scary, but we're still alive and we're still here, so we have agency. And that's also for you watching, the streaming people and the people who watch this afterwards. Like, the more fear we have around AI and machine learning, the more power it has over us, and the more we're unable to recognize what it actually is, which is this thing that has existed for much longer than the lay people understand, right? We see ChatGPT and we're like, oh, this is the beginning. And I remember Avriel telling my cousins, like, no, this has been around for a long time. And, like, when you do this, this is machine learning. And then you do this, and they're like, wait, what? And so I think there's, like, an opportunity here to get more educated as well. And so, like, big ups to the library holding these conversations for the public to engage in this conversation. So, one, more education for, like, people outside of these worlds. I was one of those people, and I, like, have seen my own transformation from just learning about AI and machine learning. And then two, I think people recognizing, like, where are the gaps? Like, where are the gaps in our industry, specifically around art? If you're an artist, like, learning more about those gaps. And then I think number three, I'm a big fan of, like, organizing and joining organization. And there are many organizations that are doing incredible work around challenging big corporations and challenging the ways in which human beings get exploited through AI. So I think that, you know, your work that you're doing, Avriel, AI for Abolition, there's a few other organizations that you told me about backstage you should tell people about.
Algorithmic Justice League is doing really good work right now around writers' rights and intellectual property and data rights. Data for Black Lives is another amazing organization. Last month, we had Encode Justice here, which is a youth-led organization that fights for algorithmic justice as well from the youth perspective. So yes, absolutely, many amazing folks building organizations that are doing this work.
Yeah, and I think the last point is very, very critical because the public conversation around AI and machine learning is quite nascent. It's going to take a bit of time for the public to understand that we have rights, that there's like a justice narrative that's a part of this. And so just learning about those orgs and, you know, joining those orgs, like I've been in the fight around criminal justice reform for 20 years now, and I remember at the very beginning when we were first talking about jails and prisons being bad and people being like, oh, I didn't know that we could talk about it like that. And so I feel like that's where we're at with this conversation around AI and machine learning with the public. For the tech folks, like you've been having these conversations, but like the public narrative, like this is very nascent. So just reminding this audience that we all have agency in where this technology goes and where it grows.
Absolutely, thank you for that. You know, looking beyond what the battle that the WGA has won, quite frankly, looking toward policy initiatives or ways of doing business that are innovative, what do you all see as like the future landscape for ways to protect creators and support innovation at the same time? And what are some things specifically, if you have any, that folks in this audience might be able to support or just learn more about?
Some of the things that I find really helpful and interesting is very specific protocols. This is a little outside of entertainment, but for example, week back, attended a panel about, hey, how do we make sure that things like deepfakes or mislabeled information doesn't get into war crime open investigations? Then turns out there's actually a really nice Berkeley protocol for how to do these things. Similarly with the strikes, there's a very specific, hey, this is the summary of how you do these types of things. Inside of tech companies, things like, how do you write an algorithmic policy? There is no standard handbook for that. So many folks in industry are trying to do this now. And there are whole areas, for example, trust and safety teams who've done content policy are now doing things like algorithmic policy, the foundations of professionals working in those spaces. But also, for example, there's a nice Adobe initiative about, okay, how do we actually make sure that we treat certain types of image data in a specific way? So these really, this domain, specific problem, here's a protocol of steps that we know works. We tried it out, we collaborated with a bunch of people. I find those extremely helpful because there's something really interesting sometimes that happens when you work with tech teams. They're not opposed to doing things more responsibly often, but then you're like, all right, I convinced all these people that we should do something. And then those people go, tell me what to do. And I go, yeah, well, it's complicated. Mm-hmm. That's not very inspiring. And you wanna get that intrinsic motivation like rolling by having very concrete, this is an example of how it worked, or this is a business model that actually feeds more folks and not just rolls everything up to the top.
Yeah, and I think legislation is actually really important right now and pressing for it. You know, this is actually something, in dealing with the strike, I would end up talking to people working in Washington, and surprisingly, it's actually a bipartisan issue, you know, figuring out like how to advocate for people, for humans. Surprisingly, humans are very popular. There's a lot of money going into this from I would say, the side of the Microsofts of the world, the Googles of the world, and the Amazons of the world. I mean, godless amounts of money. You cannot imagine how much money is spent on lobbying, and now with these lawsuits and everything. I think it's important that people are loud and request legislation. For example, there's one group, the Human Artistry Campaign, that was pushing for legislation governing deepfakes, yep. because that's something that affects actors, because that's their livelihood, their image is their livelihood, but also affects, like, 16-year-old girls who are being harassed mm-hmm. by deepfake technology. Like that, like, and there aren't laws on the books for this? There probably should be, because that goes way beyond just, like, how do I get paid for an artwork? Sorry.
No. I was going to say, I mean, it impacts the work that Patrice has been doing for a long time around over-policing of, black and brown people.
Absolutely. Like, dealing with the data sets. I think the biggest thing for me right now, because I think it's like the devil is in these details, and the company's kind of, like, pioneering these foundation models are being rather opaque. I think the biggest thing for me now would be, what is the training data of any given AI system? An image generator, yep. a large language model, an audio generator. When OpenAI releases Sora, the video generator, there was actually this very funny moment where the Wall Street Journal asked Mira Murati, I'm butchering her name, the CTO of OpenAI. They're like, oh, we're demonstrating Sora. We're gonna, create video. You no longer need to pay people to, make video content. Art, is the word I'd rather use. Mm-hmm. But, and the Wall Street Journal reporter said, wow, that's really amazing. So what is it trained on?
Exactly.
And Mira kind of went, because they probably scraped YouTube.
That's right.
I mean, they did scrape YouTube. Let's not be coy about it. But she didn't want to admit that. And I think that there is a demand, like, before we can responsibly legislate and figure out how to make these things workable for humans, we need to know what they are composed of, because the training data is the most important part of these systems.
Great.
Absolutely. Okay, I have one final question before we open it up for the audience, but for the artists on the panel, what is the role of generative AI in your artistic processes? Is there a place for it that you think is ethical and responsible for folks who want to incorporate these tools into their artistic practices, and how do you think about that for yourself?
Yeah, did you have something else you wanted to say?
No, go for
okay.
it.
Okay, yeah, I think it's exciting. Like, so there's all these problems, obviously, because we live in a world with problems. We also live in a world of, like, creativity and fun and love and joy, and I think, for me, I've been using AI specifically for a project that I call Abolitionist Meditations. Avriel and I work on it together, and it's pulling images to develop, like, beautiful landscapes that is, like, met with me doing a meditation around the future of abolition and abolition in real time. I believe that abolition is not just the getting rid of, but also the imagining new worlds. And so they have been really these, like, beautiful escapes and these beautiful, like, moments for the community. They're all on social media. And for me and for the audience, like, there's been such amazing feedback for this, because it feels like an intervention and a new kind of conversation. And I'm also very interested in, like, how to trick the algorithm around, like, around who I am online, because there's a certain vision, there's a certain version that's online of me that gets, like, used over and over again. And so Abolitionist Meditations was, like, my intervention inside the algorithm to be like, boop, guess what, now I'm doing meditation. And I felt like that was very, it felt very, like, it gave me a lot of agency, just, like, personally, but also I felt like a really a necessary creative kind of shock to my system. And I also am in, like, constant conversation about AI with folks, like, just constantly talking to artists about it and, like, when do we share if we're using AI? Do we share, like, do we want to use AI? Like, there's just a lot of, like, organic conversations inside of the art world right now where we're trying to understand our relationship to this technology and, does it lessen our art or does it enhance our art? Like, is that a personal opinion? Where is there a conversation sort of in the fine art world around the legacy of, like, how art changes? You sent me a really cool TikTok around someone talking about, like, the evolution into Impressionism and like how that was like a, you know, like a, people thought that was cheap. And so I think there is this, aside from the capitalist part of this all, there's this creative, like just purely creative conversation around like, what is the evolution of an art practice inside of the legacy of art? And that's what I'm really interested around this technology.
I would like to be excited about it, but I think there are exciting things. Like, listen, I look at Sora and I'm like, what could I do with that? That's an interesting instrument.
I think that's a very natural human response to getting a new tool. How can I use that tool?
Can I do it? Yeah. What I would like is that that tool was more equitably created so that the people whose work, because again, it is a derivative product. It is a thing that is derived from the work and labor of others. Yep. And right now, the way our stuff is structured, the way our society is structured, the money going into that and going back to that is kind of going to five companies that already have a lot of money. So it's kind of weird to me that they just like, in like, there's this incredible thing about the internet where it was a kind of public commons. You know, Wikipedia was just like, it worked through the benefit, through the hard work of volunteers. Reddit, the same thing. Instagram, like all these forums where people were posting their art out of the goodness of sharing. And now that's kind of been fenced in and turned into, again, a site, kind of an engine of exploitation and plagiaristic output. And it would be nice if there was a way that the people whose work was actually powering it were being compensated or had any agency whatsoever. And again, I think it's actually not impossible. You know, I think one of the things the strike taught us was even just by being loud, we could change some of the directions these companies were going in. I remember when the strike started, OpenAI would brag about how through ChatGPT, oh, you could write something in the style of Ernest Hemingway. You could write something in the style of George R.R. Martin. You know, it was like a thing that they thought was cool. As a writer, that's truly kind of offensive and immoral. And we were loud about that, and the strike magnified that loudness. And now OpenAI and Sam Altman are a little bit like, well, we're not going to do that. You can't imitate known writers or living writers for whom this is how they make their living, who share their work. You know, you can't write the end of Game of Thrones, rewrite it, you know, through ChatGPT with, you know, without George R. R. Martin's consent or even his awareness. They kind of changed their tune on that because we were loud about that. So I would like to be excited about that. The other thing, and this is kind of tangential to the art space, but I think something we all need to keep in common, keep in the back of our minds, is just the environmental and energy impact of these models. Draining water, taking up real estate for these data centers, like the GPU market is kind of insane right now. And the energy demands that, you know, you've got like the Sam Altmans and the Mark Zuckerbergs and the, you know, Microsofts of the world just being like, oh yeah, we'll just build another nuclear power plant to like power a foundation model. It's like, whoa, like where are we prioritizing our resources? Like this is, we're already kind of in a climate crisis anyway. So are we doing this the smartest way we possibly could? Asking those questions. So if we could answer those, I would be a lot more excited. As it is, it is a double-edged sword because you're like, what could be done with this that like I can sleep with at night? And the last thing I will say, sorry, I want to rant on this, but remembering how it works, not anthropomorphizing the machine, remembering it's like it's a gigantic mathematical equation run on massive powers, massive globs of compute, but remembering like, oh, this is just a tool. I got to keep the human-centered element for it. It's going to have gaps. The data sets aren't complete. They are not representative of society at large. They fall into cliche. They fall into the median, the average. You just got to remember that when you use it. And just be very thoughtful. I think just being thoughtful.
But also give yourself the grace that, yes, research shows that people treat agents, even if they're AI agents, as
human beings. Yep.
But for everyone, yes, you do have the agency over these AI agents by asking the right questions at the right moments. And again, it's not necessarily always out of a, like, oh, it's intended to be this way. Mm-hmm. It's perhaps that someone actually hasn't thought about this before.
Right.
But asking the right questions in the right way so you're not asking about something that can really easily be like, that's actually not relevant. That's technically not how it works. No, asking the right things is super important.
And being careful not to alienate and ostracize the other labor force that maybe seems in opposition, but actually, in reality, we are all facing very similar challenges in our work. Yeah, thank you so much, everyone, for this amazing conversation. I want to open it up for just a couple of questions. And I think there are some microphones that are floating around. So if you would like to ask any of us a question, please raise your hand. Okay, great. And please remember to introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Matt, and I don't know if the microphone's working. It sounds like it's picking up. There we go. Interesting conversation. Appreciate your contributions today. I guess I kind of have a legal question. I want to put the ethics to the side, if those aren't, you know, the same. And I thought the devil's bargain that everyone made with social media was that when you posted to keep in, you know, keep in contact with your friends, that you were assigning over your rights over the works. And like, you know, it's a horrible situation that we landed in where that ended up being a, you know, private entity owning or being intermediary between the conversation we were having, but weren't we sort of giving them access to eventually train the models? And so I'm wondering, hopefully that the power dynamic shifted back to the people at some point, and I missed that along the way, but do you guys have any sort of like update on that and thinking about the legal battle that's gonna happen with the New York Times? And is there legal standing that we as contributors and creators could see a favorable decision in, you know, having those algorithms reflect our own works, I guess?
You mean in terms of compensation or?
Maybe not just compensation, but at least that, we're living in a democracy. We hope to have some say over things. Are we going to have some say over things?
Well, we do live in a democracy, and these guys are accountable to the legislation that is passed. So, you know, there, believe it or not, I think there is enough political will to pass legislation. Just, I could be Pollyannish, but in my conversations, it seems it does cross, like, very few things these days cross Democrat and Republican, because I think it's popular with voters. Now, obviously, this is going to be decided in the courts, some of this. There is a standing body of law about IP and copyright where, you know, copyright instantiates in you, the author. Whether or not you copyright something, you have a copyright claim. The question is data training, machine learning, is that an acceptable, fair use of someone's underlying work? I personally don't believe it is. I think you need to enter in a licensing regime. Before I was a writer, one of my gig jobs for health insurance was I was a business affairs assistant, and I helped do music licensing for film and television. You can't just use any song or piece of music, like even like 15 5-second clips for anything you want that you're gonna try and profit off of. You have to strike a deal with the underlying rights holder of the music. And that market worked, and that market sprang into existence because of advances in technologies in the 60s and 70s. So I think it is possible, you know, depending on how these court cases are tried. Obviously, there's a little bit of a coin flip. You know, the Copyright Office is going to start making some determinations soon. Yeah, unfortunately, the period for comment is kind of closed. So that sphere, that javelin at the one regulatory agency that has power right now is kind of in the air, and hopefully it will land favorably on the human side as opposed to the corporate side. There's no guarantees. The lawsuits, I mean, if you know judges or lawyers, educate them, tell them to educate themselves about AI, because I think there's a lot of jargon and a lot of, like, again, anthropomorphized language that tries to make arguments based on rights that were created for human beings and not individuals. I just think the more you talk about this, the more it gets in the public air, and like, so when judges make these decisions and when lawyers fight these battles, it'll be a little bit fairer. And we just, we have to see, we have to fight for legislation, we have to keep talking about it. You know, the EU did a really good job with its EU AI Act. The US has to do something similar. And unfortunately, we're in an election year, so nothing's gonna happen until this election is decided. This election, in addition to all the other reasons it's important, is probably gonna be important because the few people within the current government who I think are AI, like, this is an opinion, this does not reflect the views of the WGA, just from what I know, the Biden administration has actually done a really good job thinking about AI and giving a mandate to its individual agencies to do something about it. The FTC in particular, because they've already been interested in monopolistic practices, has done an incredible job of driving this conversation forward. Lena Khan is like very, like, this is important to her. I know she's working hard on it. She sent an information request for OpenAI asking that explicit question, what is your training data? Unfortunately, until the, like, we're in election year.
How important do you think it's going to be to vote down ballot for this issue?
You mean by down ballot?
Like, I mean, how far down ballot do we need to be thinking about this issue? Like, obviously at the level of representatives and senators, but also do state and local officials play a role, especially here in California? Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah, no. I mean, in California, again, a lot of the legislation, and this is something that, again, I'm going off a little bit of what I know less of. But I know, for example, SAG has been pushing for legislation that codifies rights of publicity around human individual likenesses that it can affect deepfakes. Tennessee just passed something. There's another bill that I forget the exact specifics of it, that again, it's about disclosing the training data. And I think it was Ted Lieu, or I remember the wrong one, someone in California, you know, tried to get a Republican, I think, to go on board with him, but again, it's election year. So it's all the way down ballot. I mean, look at your state representatives, your congressional representatives, your senators, obviously whoever is president is gonna have a big impact on this. And not just because of who they are as president, but because who they appoint to the individual. Like I said, so far from what I've seen, Lina Khan is the one person in the government currently doing something about the corporate element of this. And I know they're terrified of her because they, like, I see how much hate she gets from certain sectors of the industry. But it's also like she's asking the questions that need to be asked. You know, she's saying, like, you can't just do whatever you want now. You know, there are considerations for people. And ultimately, these corporations, you know, we do vote and we do have some sway over them. So I guess down ballot, it's very important to vote down ballot.
Yeah, thank you. Did you want to add something to that?
Yes. Law is extremely important, but AI governance is more than just going, this is law. So things like standards, methods, protocols, extremely important. And yes, there are official agencies doing really interesting work, like, for example, NIST doing lots of standards work. But it is really
important. What's NIST? What is that? Do you know? The National
Institute for Standards in Technology.
I think that's it. Yeah.
It's something like
put
that, but
me
I just
on
yeah,
the spot. Yeah,
no, I'm sorry. I just didn't want people to be like, "What is that?"
But definitely that sense of yes, law is important, but there's no way that all these situations in time can be done. So also asking the questions of what are the standards here, if you are building something, and what are the regular ways that you do things? Because yes, it didn't used to be the case that you made a note of which training data you used like 10 years ago. That wasn't like, yeah, you would use things, but it was more about like, oh, cool, we can make data sets that are reliable. And there's also a lot of tensions, even if you, for example, audit algorithmic systems. Let's say you would want to go, I want to know how certain demographics, like certain artists, are affected by my decisions. There's a tension between data minimization and having all that data to even be able to do that. So you constantly encounter these like, oh, don't know how to do this. So you can't wait completely for the legal framework to be done.
Thank you for that. Any other questions? Yes, I see one here. We have time for one more? Okay, great. I see one in the front.
I can only make sense of AI in the context of things that I learn and what I know. So for instance, Tylenol is a brand, but the composition is acetaminophen, which then is sold in terms of generic drugs. And Tylenol is more expensive, generic drugs is much cheaper, right? But Tylenol has a patent of sorts that the generic brand copied, but the generic brand is more affordable and accessible to the populace. When it comes to art, music was very inaccessible because you had to have a certain amount of money and status to attend live concerts. Mm-hmm. And with recordings and streaming, it became much more accessible for the populace. Isn't that a little bit of what AI does to creatives and what creatives having a bit of exclusivity, you know. But then, you know, buying an original versus buying the print, right? And so buying the print is much more affordable. And that art then is disseminated wider. So I'm playing the devil's advocate, but it's also a question, right? To what extent AI allows for the product to be more accessible, even if it's somehow plagiarized?
I would say that art is by its very nature democratic. You can pick up a pencil and you can draw. You can learn to do a you can learn an instrument. You can learn to express yourself, because ultimately it's an expressive medium. Throughout history, when we had these abilities to reproduce stuff like printing, photography, all that, new laws came into force such that authors, which again, this is an author is something that's encoded in our Constitution, could make a living doing what they do. I think the most important thing we need to think about is how artists, the future generation of artists, can continue to be artists and survive if there is no remuneration. And I think there's a huge issue in streaming because, well, it's been very remunerative for like the Taylor Swifts of the world. The middle class of artists are decimated.
Yeah.
Like, they don't make enough off of Spotify or any of these services to really practice their art in a meaningful way. They all have to keep their day jobs. They're, you know, like 1 in 100 million people becomes Taylor Swift. I think we need to think about ways that allow that, because the biggest concern I had as a writer, as I saw the stuff being debuted, was what would it do to the entry-level writer to become good at your craft, to be good at learning how to communicate to people, how to express and share ideas? You need to start somewhere. I started writing blog posts for $100 a post at no-name websites, and that allowed me to build a career. That job is now being automated to AI. And I am concerned about future generations of artists, because what AI does in and of itself, or the current generative AI models, it kind of freezes in place like knowledge. And you need to be pushing the boundaries of knowledge. And we need young people. Like, I'm a TV writer, I have healthcare, hopefully, if Hollywood doesn't implode, I will be okay. What I'm more worried about is the next me, like the young me. How is that person going to learn to master their craft and be good at what they do so that they can create human-centered stuff for people? And I think that this technology is not quite like the printing press, and it is not quite like photography. It doesn't change things. It doesn't make it easier. It kind of like commodifies someone's work in the hands of a giant corporation that then extracts value from that. Because the money that used to go to a young 20-something writer trying to learn his craft and break in is now going to OpenAI. You know, anytime that, you know, and that, by the way, that's not to sound like a Luddite or, like, you know, someone who hates technology. I think there are uses for it. It's really good at templates. If you want to write a form letter, it's really good at writing form letters. You know, but when it comes to something that's about creative, individual, personal expression, something that's protected in our Constitution, I think that's kind of the difference. And it's, again, about the structures of something that is inherently democratic, but, you know, artists need to eat and survive, too.
I love your question, because one of the interesting things here is how do you create a system so that high quality, I hate to call it content, I'm sorry, high quality content or products or, like, effortful artistry get funded. And right now, what I'm worried about a little bit is that it becomes really easy to have that, like, demo stage information, but the incentive to go read a journalistic deep dive, or even, like, I'm in research and a whole research paper versus a cool TikTok that, like, quickly explains what the world looks like. And it's supposed to be my job to read those papers, right? So how to create those systems and incentives to actually make that work? Because in the end, a lot of these systems did work because they created access, so you could actually have access to all of that music or movies. So clearly there's a clear like reason why people use them.
Thank you so much. And thank you to people in the audience who engaged and for your intention. Can we get a round of applause for our panelists, please? Really enjoyed this conversation. And Jessica, take it away. Close us out.
Thank you. This was really informative and terrific and makes me want to know more, which I knew this whole series would, and helps to educate me, who's just knows nothing about any of this. So thank you all for being here. We do have the PST, which is Pacific Standard Time, which the Getty chooses various culturals around Southern California. We, the Library Foundation, and the library, we have the curator of this project and the artist that we have brought in, and she is creating a utopian machine. And we would love people's ideas for that. So there is a card in the library on the desk. And if you want to fill it out with your idea of what your machine would look like, we would love, or she would love, to look at that. And perhaps a part of it will be in the final machine. Our next program is at the El Rey, and it's both conversation and music surrounding the Grateful Dead and a particular concert they did. Thank you all for being here this evening, and I want to thank all of you again. Thank you.
Allowed is made possible by Hearst Foundations, Golden Globes Foundation, LA County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox Schiff, the Steve and Judith Krantz Foundation, Estate of Suzanne E. Aaron, and individual Library Foundation donors and members. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library. To support programs like these, become a member at lfla.org.